And as we sign away from Captain Fred's World Cruise, let's fade into Mideast Migraines here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and of course, as ever, streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freak, F-R-E-A-K, radio.org. If you happen to be listening to us on the old tune box, keep in mind, the next time you go online, you go to freakradio.org and follow the instructions for picking up our stream service on the internet. Click on the listen link there at Freak Radio, or just click on the red oval on top of the transmission tower. I think that still works. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org, and broadcasting to the city of Santa Cruz on the left coast of Central California here at 101.3 FM. It's 3:06 in the afternoon, 1506 hours. On this Monday, January 19, in the year 2015, and that, if that jives with your personal time-space continuum, 3:06 p.m., Monday, January 19th, then you know that the program is live, so you may call in at any time, any of you, including that dude I was chatting with on the Amazon.com website an hour ago. The area code to the studio here, live and all that, is area code 831-427-3772. That's 831-427-3772. Once more, 831-427-3772. What do we want to talk about today? Thing is, there really is a lot to talk about. I mean, as ever, there is. Let's begin with the usual dissertation from Professor Mazin Kumsier, an instructor at university in the West Bank. Mazin Kumsier has a regular blog, as do gazillions of people on the planet. But let's hear from Palestinian blogger for once, shall we? Okay, this is dated. Where in the heck is the date here? Oh, this just came in today to me. Professor Kumsier writes, "The lawyers have sat in council, the men with the keen, long faces, and said, 'This man is a fool.' And others have said, 'He blasphemeth.' And the wise have pitied the fool that hath striven to give a life. In the world of time and space, among the bulks of actual things, to a dream that was dreamed in the heart, and that only the heart could hold. O wise men, riddle me this. What if the dream come true?" That was that was entitled "The Revolutionary," but by Padraig Pierce in The Fool, wider work, The Fool. Let me read it again. "The lawyers have sat in council, the men with the keen, long faces, and said, 'This man is a fool.' And others have said, 'He blasphemeth.' And the wise have pitied the fool that hath striven to give a life in the world of time and space among the bulks of actual things to a dream that was dreamed in the heart, and that only the heart could hold. O wise men, riddle me this. What if the dream come true?" Our work at the Palestine Museum of Natural History is one such dream coming true, and soon a free Palestine. Jesse is back after more than a month in the United States and will volunteer full time. Though they gave her a visa for Palestine Authority, Palestinian Authority areas only. We did not apply in time for a visitor visa for Professor Zuhair Amir from Jordan, who is helping us in research, so we will have to wait on that. But we are getting visiting collaborators all the time, next month from as far away as Germany and the U.S. We are also getting donations in money and material. This is the Palestine Museum of Natural History that Kumsier is talking about here. We even just received a very old Bedouin face slash headdress of hand-knotted maroon silk beadwork, some amber. I take that to mean authentic amber, the material, not the color, and a lot of authentic old Turkish coins of silver, brass, and nickel. Thanks, Y. Petretti, for donating this very valuable historical item. We welcome all donations in kind, material. knowledge, etc. Donors, visitors, volunteers, and activists, this human factor, guarantees we will succeed as we develop respect for ourselves, for others, for nature. We are in a race against time and we must win. Please look at these NASA charts that show the impact of human activity on our planet. And there's a link that I don't think I'll bother going to since only I can see it. It has to do with, the link is essentially climate.nasa.gov/vital signs/carbon dioxide. So we've got Palestinians who amongst their many and myriad activities allegedly involved, supposedly every last one of them in terrorism and in supposedly killing every last Jew in Israel, they are watching out for themselves, for their own culture and environment, and one of these outlets is the Palestine Museum of Natural History. The thing that I find disconcerting is Kumsier points out towards the end of that piece I just read, we are in a race against time and we must win. Well, that's certainly true for those who subscribe to and believe in the threat of human-generated climate change and global warming. Race against time for everyone on the planet, not just Arabs, not just Jews, Palestinians or Israelis, but everyone. I can't help but wonder, though, if Kumsier is also talking about the race against time and against Israel, as Israel will probably find some way to sabotage and hinder the development of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. But my main point is Palestinians have endeavors that just plain have to do with improving their own lot, their own circumstances. It's not as though the Palestinian Arabs, the Muslims, the Christians, or anyone else, that every last thing they're doing is directed towards trying to do Israel in, trying to kick all the Jews into the sea. I mean, after all, it is the Palestinians, ever since 1948, who systematically have been kicked into the sea of forgottenness, the world pretty much abandoning their plight. The Palestinian Arabs being kicked into the sea of less fertile land. And even much of that is consistently being taken away from them by drip irrigation-oriented Israeli settlers who are not supposed to be on that land. It's not right, it's not ethical, it's also illegal. Basically, everyone in the world community agrees that the Jewish settlers in Palestine are illegal. And that's on top of this 47-odd year military occupation of Palestine, an occupation bearing no practical fruit for the native people who live there, namely the Arab Palestinians, is illegal. A military occupation which does virtually nothing to protect the lives, well-being, and security of Israeli citizens, but continues to dash the lives and the culture and the hopes of Palestinians who are under occupation. Okay, I'm starting to sound like FM radio here. By the way, my name is Ren Tawil, your local friendly neighborhood Palestinian American. Actually, I was born in San Francisco, but I have enough of a link with my own past in order to get my message and my sentiment across. Don't forget, you can call me at area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-3772. You can always go to our website, which has the studio number listed on that as well. 427-3772. More by Professor Kumsier. NYTI, New York Times, what, internet? Norman.ms. We are encouraged as President Obama seems to be moving forward with normalization of relations with Cuba, and we hope soon with Iran. Here we can dream. Palestine. Wait, what's he trying to say here? And we hope soon with Iran, and we can dream Palestine. President Obama, like all presidents, in the end, towards the end of their office, seemed to be noticing how deadly and harmful is the Israel First lobby in Washington. The writing here is terrible. Maybe it has to do with translation from Al-Arabiya. See this for how Israel lackeys continue to put their money ahead of national interest, the U.S. national interest. Okay. I'm trying to see that. The New York Times. Obama and Senator Robert Menendez spar on how to handle Iran. January 15. Let's see. That's last Thursday. President Obama and Senator Robert Menendez traded sharp words on Thursday over whether Congress should vote to impose new sanctions on Iran, while the administration is negotiating with Tehran, Iran's capital, hence slight code for Iran's government, while the administration is negotiating with Tehran about its nuclear program, according to two people who witnessed the exchange. When Obama and Menendez traded sharp words. In the course of the argument, which was described as tense but generally respectful, Mr. Obama vowed to veto legislation being drafted by Mr. Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, and Senator Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois, that would trigger sanctions after multi-party talks are set to end this summer. This coming summer. So, the bad guys here are looking towards triggering sanctions in, what, 6, 7, 8 months' time? After multi-party talks are set to end this summer. Their face-off occurred behind closed doors at the Hilton Hotel in Baltimore, where the two-day Senate Democratic Issues Conference was taking place. The president spoke to the senators for nearly 2 hours, and several people said he was well-received by members of his party, as he vowed to remain on the political offensive during the final 2 years of his presidency. His exchange with Mr. Menendez occurred near the end of a question-and-answer session after Senator Angus King of Maine, an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, asked for an update to the nuclear talks. According to one of the senators and another person who was present, the president urged lawmakers to stop pursuing sanctions, saying such a move would undermine his authority and could derail the talks. Mr. Obama also said that such a provocative action could lead international observers to blame the Americans rather than the Iranians if the talks collapsed before the June 30 deadline. Now, I'm trying to see what this has to do with Israeli security. I'm sorry, with what I said in the earlier Kumsie piece. Israel lackeys continue to put their money ahead of the U.S. national interests. I'm looking. Keep that in mind, folks. That's what we're looking towards. The president said he understood the pressures that senators face from donors and others, but he urged the lawmakers to take the long view rather than make a move for short-term political gain, according to the senator. Menendez, who was seated at a table in front of the podium, stood up and said he took personal offense. What? The president noting that he has donors and pressure from lobbyists. Says here, Mr. Menendez told the president that he had worked for more than 20 years to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions and had always been focused on the long-term implications. Mr. Menendez also warned the president that sanctions could not be imposed quickly in Congress if Congress waited to act and the talks failed, according to two people who were present. Yeah, I'm looking for that, for any direct... Well, the thing is, the word Israel or Israelis or even Netanyahu are not mentioned anywhere in this article. But what Kumsier here obviously is getting at is that there is consistent and long-time pressure from Israel, from the Israeli government and their Washington lobby force, AIPAC, pressure from them to get the president and to get Congress to stop pursuing essentially the nonviolent tactic of economic sanctions in order to get Israel to comply in terms of their nuclear program. I mean, it sounds almost contradictory to say that economic sanctions and then the pressure that that brings is a form of nonviolence, but it is far and away what Israel wants to be able to do, and Israel wants to be able for themselves to get the green light from the U.S., and effectively from the United Nations, to launch a military attack on nuclear or suspected nuclear facilities in Iran from the air, or perhaps other kinds of missiles. Israel does have the nuclear capability themselves of striking Iran in that way. And either for Israel to do that or for the United States to contribute to or even to be the main quote-unquote coalition force in striking Iran. Israel wants war on Iran. Democratic President Barack Obama prefers sanctions. And certainly it frustrates Israel and it frustrates Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that there has been the degree of success that there has been engaging Iran, engaging constructively, engaging Iran in that manner. So this is what Kumsier obviously is talking about. He sees the whole, any instance of any senator or House member in the U.S. Congress, Republican or Democrat, to try to scuttle negotiations with Iran as an extension of the will of Israel over U.S. policy. And there is definitely plenty of that. And why are you misbehaving here? Okay. Let's... Okay. I would like to find something to say about the whole Charlie Hebdo thing in Paris, France. This looks interesting. Free speech? Charlie Hebdo, the cartoon host for the whole Charlie Hebdo political cartooning operation there in Paris. This says, Charlie Hebdo fired a quote-unquote anti-Semitic cartoonist for ridiculing Judaism in 2009. Well, that can't be anything as bad as guys with machine guns invading and killing a dozen odd people in a forceful strike that happened some 10 days ago. There's a cartoon of a smiling white man here pointing to a newspaper with a caricature of a Muslim declaring it's free speech. And the next picture is holding up another cartoon of a Jew, and someone is slapping their hand in front of his mouth and saying, it's anti-Semitism. Okay, I know, you'd have to see it to appreciate it. This is from January 14th of this year. It's from We Are Anonymous, whoever Anonymous is. Charlie Hebdo fired a quote-unquote anti-Semitic cartoonist for ridiculing Judaism in 2009. And this is written by H. Quanon. The cartoon world's double standards on freedom of speech. Charlie Hebdo mocks the Prophet Muhammad through insulting cartoons and calls it satire. As a result, half of the magazine's staff is wiped out by terrorists in the name of Allah, their name for God. The massacre raises questions about, quote, freedom of speech. The cartoon world, media, governments, and intellectuals all have double standards regarding the answer. When the world was condemning the January 7th attack on the satirical magazine, Muslim heroes were being applauded and world leaders and dignitaries were walking in a march for unity. For unity, folks, although it was not shoulder to shoulder. And there's a color picture here of a rather remarkable looking wedge-shaped march of people in suits and ties, apparently, with the caption, critics suggest images don't show dignitaries. Critics suggest images show dignitaries didn't lead the march after all, but many still speak positively about the display of global unity. The article continues, you know, if you're just talking about the march not being shoulder to shoulder. Then came the breaking news. A reminder that 80-year-old Maurice Sinnott, political cartoonist with Charlie Hebdo for 20 years, was fired in 2009 for his anti-Semitic cartoons, mocking the relationship of former French President Sarkozy's son with a wealthy Jewish woman. That was Maurice Sinnott. They're talking about Maurice Sinnott, known to the world as Sine, faced charges of, quote, inciting racial hatred for a column he wrote in July 2009. Safer Sine followed the engagement of Jean Sarkozy to Jessica Sabon d'Arte, the Jewish heiress of a major consumer electronics company, the Darty Group, commenting on rumors that Jean intended to convert from Catholicism to Judaism, Jessica's religion, for social success, Sine quipped, he'll go a long way in life, that little lad. It didn't take long for Claude Oskolovich, a high-profile political journalist, to accuse Sine of anti-Semitism. Charlie Hebdo's editor, Philippe Val, who republished Gillan's Posten's controversial cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in the name of freedom of press in 2006, agreed that the piece was offensive and asked Sine to apologize. Sine refused, saying, I'd rather cut my balls off. He was fired and taken to court by the Ligue Internationale contre le Racisme et Antisemitisme, LICRA, an organization which works to promote racial tolerance. In December 2010, Sine won a 40,000 euro court judgment against his former publisher for a wrongful termination. Charlie Hebdo publishes cartoons insulting Islam and Muslims as well as Jesus and Christianity and tags them as, quote, freedom of speech. However, in the case of Sine, it failed to stand firm on its provocation provocative freedom of speech stance. And by the way, it is 3:30 p.m. here Pacific Standard Time on the central coast of California, 3:31 p.m. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. for Monday, January 19, 2015. Carlos Letoff, a world-renowned Brazilian cartoonist, told Daily Sabah, quote, "It is an everlasting discussion because what is freedom of speech and what is hate speech? Why are some subjects protected by freedom of speech and others not? Why can we mock some issues and cannot do so with others? Should Holocaust denial, for example, be included as freedom of speech or racial hatred? As freedom of speech or as racial hatred? See, for example, the treatment given by the Western mainstream media to Muhammad cartoons and the Holocaust cartoons," end quote. Letoff added that the motive behind the urge to mock Islam remains unknown. Quote, "Who knows? Hatred against Muslims, testing the limits of freedom of speech, mocking Muslims just for fun, who knows? However, the fact is that they," the Charlie Hebdo editors, "died not for a good cause, what could be seen as noble, but for provoking Muslims and feeding the hatred against Islam." More cartoons here. Coming in pairs. Pairs of single box drawings. Drawing about Jews. The Iron Fist of the West comes down on a man drawing a picture of a Hasidic Jew here with the side curls and the black hat. "Is anti-Semitism," says the West. Drawing about Muslims, the West is coddling this white, presumably French, cartoonist and says it's freedom of speech. If it's about Jews, it's anti-Semitism. If it's about Muslims, it's freedom of speech. So, and that's actually, those cartoons were presented at the end of the article with the proviso here. These are some of Letoff's cartoons that speak a thousand words. WikiLeaks on January 8 blamed the persecution of Sine at the request of a Jewish, quote, pro-censorship lobby for legitimizing the terrorist attacks on Charlie Hebdo. Now, you see what they're saying there? WikiLeaks blamed the persecution of Sine, the man who made so-called anti-Semitic cartoons against Jews or against a particular case of the son of a leader of France and his romantic and economic connections with a rich Jewish woman. WikiLeaks blamed persecution of that cartoonist at the request of a Jewish pro-censorship lobby for legitimizing the terrorist attacks on Charlie Hebdo. In other words, it is Sine's fault, according to WikiLeaks, according to this article. I think they just mean it was reported or allowed to be included in WikiLeaks section there. Reported that the French cartoonist died at the behest of Sine for his supposedly anti-Semitic cartoons. How the Jewish pro-censorship lobby legitimized attacks on Charlie Hebdo for, quote, offensive speech. Gets right into it, doesn't it? God, if I can bring that, I can only bring that up. That would definitely be worth looking at. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 on the FM dial, and streaming live at freakradio.org. Okay, you want to take your time here? Let's move on to something else. Rather, let's just go ahead with this. This is from the Telegraph. Today, 19 January. French cartoonist Ciné on trial on charges of anti-Semitism over the Sarkozy jibe. French cartoonist Ciné on trial on charges of anti-Semitism over Sarkozy jibe. A left-wing cartoonist is to go on trial on Tuesday on charges of anti-Semitism for suggesting that Jean Sarkozy, the son of the French president, former French president, was converting to Judaism for financial reasons. Or the suggestion that it was for financial reasons that the president's son was converting. By Henry Samuel in Paris. Maurice Ciné, 80 years old, who works under the pen name Ciné, S-I-N-E, leaving off the T, faces charges of, quote, inciting racial hatred for a column he wrote last July in the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. The piece sparked a summer slanging match among the Parisian intelligentsia and ended in his dismissal from the magazine. L'affaire Ciné followed the engagement of Mr. Sarkozy, 22 years old, to Jessica Sabon d'Arty, the Jewish heiress of an electronic goods chain, commenting on an unfounded rumor that the president's son planned to convert to Judaism. Ciné quipped, "He'll go a long way in life, that little lad." A high-profile political commentator slammed the column as linking prejudice about Jews and social success. Charlie Hebdo's editor, Philippe Val, asked Ciné to apologize, but he refused, exclaiming, "I'd rather cut my balls off." Mr. Val's decision to fire Ciné was backed by a group of eminent intellectuals, including the philosopher Bernard Henry Levy, but parts of the libertarian left defended him, citing the right to free speech. Last week, the anti-capitalist, anti-clerical Ciné, who recently founded his own weekly magazine, Ciné Hebdo, took Claude Askolovich, the journalist who first accused him of anti-Semitism, to court for slander in a desperate case. When I heard that I was being treated as anti-Semitic, my blood ran cold, he said during the trial, adding that if Mr. Askolovich had turned up in person, it is not a trial he would have had, but a headbutt. Ciné is a defendant in Tuesday's court case in Lyon, southern France. The plaintiff is the anti-racism and anti-Semitism group, LICRA. The plaintiff is the anti-racism and yet anti-Semitism group, LICRA. You know, when you get all these anti-this, anti-that, lined up in a row, it can be confusing. I think what they must be saying is that LICRA is an anti-racism and an anti-Semitism group. For some people, you merely say anti-Semitism group, and it can go either way. Are they for Jews or are they against Jews? It does get confusing. Continuing here with this issue from the Telegraph, the issue of anti-Semitism, already sensitive in a country still marked by the Alfred Dreyfus affair, the Jewish army captain wrongly accused of spying in the 19th century, has become even more charged in recent weeks due to Israel's Gaza offensive. France was hit by a series of anti-Semitic ads, including firebomb attacks on synagogues. See, this article in the Telegraph is dated Monday, 19 January 2015. That's today, this year. Here we go. I'm sorry. This is a reprint. Now this is making more sense, because they're not talking entirely about all recent events. This is a reprint in today's issue of the Telegraph of an article by Henry Samuel in Paris, 27 January 2009. Thank me for making that correction. Okay, because they're talking about the Gaza offensive here as though it happened yesterday. I'll read that paragraph again. The issue of anti-Semitism, already sensitive in a country still marked by the Alfred Dreyfus affair, the Jewish army captain wrongly accused of spying in the 19th century, that's the 1800s, of course, has become even more charged in recent weeks due to Israel's Gaza offensive. France was hit by a series of anti-Semitic acts, including firebomb attacks on synagogues. The young Mr. Sarkozy, son of the former French president, who himself, the junior Sarkozy, who is now the leader of his father's party in the president's old fiefdom, the chic Paris suburb of Neuilly-sur-Seine, has since married. He has denied converting to Judaism. Some of these things can really get out of hand, can't they? Okay, I know. I really need to move on to something else here. We spent the last 42 minutes, essentially 35, 40 minutes on this stuff linked to Professor Mazin Kumsiye's, Palestinian Mazin Kumsiye's blog here. Okay. Latest blow to Israeli-Palestinian police. This was written by Stephen Zunes, who is a local, as in San Francisco Bay Area and Monterey Bay Area, professor. Stephen Zunes is a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. He resides in the Monterey Bay Area, Santa Cruz County. This is Stephen Zunes' column in Foreign Policy in Focus. The latest blow to Israeli-Palestinian peace. The United States blocked the latest UN resolution to achieve peace between Israel and Palestine for the most disingenuous of reasons. Let's really get into it. Stephen Zunes, January 13. Though not technically using its veto power, the Obama administration is responsible for the defeat of a draft United Nations Security Council resolution passed at the end of last month, December, calling for a, quote, just, lasting, and comprehensive peaceful solution, end quote, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Reiterating a series of UN Security Council resolutions supported by previous administrations, the recent draft resolution underscored Israel's right to exist in peace and security. And peace and security called for security guarantees, including international peacekeepers, and even allowed Israel to incorporate most of the illegal settlements. The resolution also underscored long-standing international legal principles regarding the inadmissibility of any country expanding its territory by force or colonizing any part of occupied territory, called for the establishment of a Palestinian state in the 22% of Palestine consisting of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, and called on Israel to withdraw its occupation forces. Unfortunately, the Obama administration apparently found such provisions unreasonable and launched a full court press to have the measure defeated. Snag attack in my throat there. I had to spray my throat. Okay. So the resolution tacked on to the original language, as it says in the paragraph here, underscoring long-standing international legal principles regarding the inadmissibility of any country expanding its territory by force, aka Israel, or colonizing any part of occupied territory, aka Israel. Actually, calling for the establishment of Palestine, the state of Palestine, the 22% of Palestine remaining, more or less, to the Palestinians, consisting of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, and called on Israel to withdraw its occupation forces. The Obama administration apparently found such provisions unreasonable and launched a full-court press to have the measure defeated. Yeah, I know, I just read that. This is just to keep us all up to date here. Ironically, the draft resolution blocked by the Obama administration was more generous to Israel than previous resolutions that passed the Security Council without U.S. objections under previous administrations. For example, rather than demanding that Israel withdraw from the territory seized in the June 1967 war, the draft resolution said the borders should simply be, quote, based on the 4th of June, 1967 lines with mutually agreed, limited, and equivalent land swaps, end quote, thereby allowing Israel in exchange for an equivalent amount of territory, legally part of Israel, to annex occupied territory in East Jerusalem and parts of the West Bank near the original border, where the majority of Israeli settlers live. This would spare the settlers from possible expulsion, since transfers of civilian populations onto territory seized by military force are illegal according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, not just according to the United Nations, for all you UN haters out there, but according to the Fourth Geneva Convention and four previous UNSC, United Nations Security Council resolutions, in a 2004 ruling of the International Court of Justice confirmed their applicability to Israeli occupied lands. So the pressure is coming down on Israel, and effectively the U.S. president comes to Israel's rescue here. The United States also objected to the resolution's call for a timetable to end the occupation. The resolution spoke of the, quote, urgent need to attain, end quote, language that falls short of a requirement, and end of the Israeli occupation within 12 months. The Obama administration, however, apparently believes that 48 years of occupation was not enough and that Israel should be able to hold on to the West Bank even longer. Again, I'm reading from an article written by Professor Stephen Zunes, from last Tuesday. From his Foreign Policy in Focus column, The Latest Blow to Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Let's continue here. The most important reason for the founding of the United Nations was to resolve international disputes. However, President Obama has insisted that the UN was not the, quote, right venue to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that the peace process should instead take place under the tutelage of the United States, which is the principal military, financial, and diplomatic supporter of the occupying power of Israel. As Haaretz reported, Haaretz is the premier, most popular, most widely read news magazine in Israel. As Haaretz reported, what most upset the United States about the draft resolution was that it, and I quote, threatened to undermine the American prominence in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, end quote. Yeah. Haaretz actually admitted it. The draft resolution threatened to undermine American promise in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, which has thus far resulted in allowing Israel to dramatically expand its illegal settlements, solidify its control of the West Bank, and make the establishment of a viable Palestinian state less and less likely. Using Orwellian logic, United States Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, claimed that the resolution calling for the establishment of two states for two peoples would somehow undermine the effort, and I quote, that makes it possible to achieve two states for two people, end quote, and that the resolution's call for a two-state solution will not bring the parties closer to achieving a two-state solution. Orwellian logic, you see. Okay, subsection here. The United States is Minority Whip. The U.S. is Minority Whip. As the only member of the 15-member Security Council besides Australia to vote against the resolution, the United States was clearly in the minority. And that, of course, means quick review of how the Security Council works. All members, all full-fledged members of the United Nations are members of the General Assembly, which is led, in terms of resolutions and what little power they have to legislate international law is concerned, led by the Security Council. The all-member state General Assembly is led by the Security Council, which itself is divided between... the Security Council is comprised of 15 members, five of which are permanent members. The United States, Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, is a member of the Council. China, which took the place of nationalist China, located on the island of Taiwan, which was not the communist state. Now it's Red China, or Communist China. United States, Russia, Red China, France, and Great Britain are permanent members of the Security Council. Those seats are never given up. They are considered the victors of the Second World War. We're the victors of the Second World War, and that's what that composition of the council is based on. The victors of the Second World War, which ended, 70 years ago now? 70 years ago. And 70 years ago this year. And the remaining 10 members of the 15-member Security Council rotate those seats among the members of the General Assembly. Australia is currently one of the 10 rotating seats on the Security Council. That's how that goes. So getting back to the article, U.S. is Minority Whip section here, is the only member of the 15-member total Security Council besides Australia, rotating member, to vote against the resolution. The United States was clearly in the minority. The majority of countries, including European NATO allies, France and Luxembourg, supported it. Indeed, France was largely responsible for the wording of the resolution the Obama administration found so unacceptable. Four countries abstained, resulting in fewer than 10 affirmative votes required for passage. So the negative vote by the United States was technically not a veto. Ooh, let me read that again, just so I can understand. Four countries abstained, resulting in fewer than the 10 affirmative votes required for passage. I wasn't even sure that the Security Council could be overridden. Just like a presidential veto in the United States Congress can be overridden. That seems to be the case. Four countries abstained, resulting in fewer than the 10 affirmative votes required for passage, so the negative vote by the United States was technically not a veto. However, the Obama administration was directly responsible for the resolution's defeat. Nigeria, which had indicated that it would support the resolution, reversed its position and abstained following a phone call from Secretary of State John Kerry to President Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria, pressuring him not to join the majority of the Security Council in supporting the measure. A phone call from the U.S. Secretary of State. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, whose government has long been dependent on U.S. aid, was also pressured to abstain. Indeed, Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, who as a senator was an outspoken supporter of the successive right-wing Israeli governments and an opponent of Palestinian self-determination, made dozens of calls to world leaders as part of the Obama administration's desperate effort to kill the resolution. So this is what uh, senior moment here. This is what Stephen Zunes is talking about, Professor Zunes is talking about, when he says that, come on, where are you? That even though the resolution's lost cannot be faulted to the United States to a U.S. veto, Zunes says that the administration was directly responsible for the resolution's defeat. He's taking into account phone calls. In effect, indirectly, if not spoken outrightly, threaten to withhold economic or political support to other members of the Security Council. So it is, in effect, a U.S. veto, is what Zunes is saying. Continuing here. The resolution would not have passed in any case, even if Kerry had failed to convince foreign leaders from changing their affirmative votes to abstentions. The United States, as one of Security Council's five permanent members, would have cast a veto. However, to once again use its veto power to support Israel's increasingly isolated right-wing government would have been a political embarrassment to the Obama administration. So, Kerry worked hard to ensure enough abstentions to block the resolution. So now I'm confused. I'm beginning to think again that no one can override a veto by any member of this, permanent member of the Security Council. New subsection, resolutions and or negotiations. We're going to have a musical break here, folks, so try not to get so antsy. We're coming up to the end of this article. Resolutions and or negotiations. Ambassador Powell tried to justify U.S. opposition by claiming that peace had to come not from action by the U.N. Security Council, but, quote, will come from hard choices and compromises that must be made at the negotiating table. Adding that the suffering, quote, will not subside until the parties reach a comprehensive settlement achieved through negotiations, end quote. This is completely disingenuous, however. There is no contradiction between negotiations and the wording of the resolution. Indeed, the resolution repeatedly underscored that fact, that the fact that any agreement would have to result from such negotiations. For example, a central paragraph calls on the parties, and he quotes here, to act together in the pursuit of peace by negotiating in good faith. The draft resolution did not dictate where the final borders are, the fate of Palestinian refugees, or other important issues, thereby leaving those for the two parties to work out in their negotiations. Power also deliberately misled the public by claiming that the resolution was, quote, deeply unbalanced, and, quote, addresses the concerns of only one side. In fact, the resolution was explicitly based on the goal of two independent democratic and prosperous states, Israel, and a sovereign, contiguous, and viable state of Palestine. And that's all in quotations, too. Sovereign, contiguous, in other words, geographically continuous, all connected and viable state of Palestine. The resolution directly addressed Israel's security concerns by calling for measures that would ensure the security of both Israel and Palestine through effective border security and by preventing the resurgence of terrorism, including a third-party presence, and called for the recognition of Israel and an end to additional territorial claims. Many Palestinians actually welcomed the defeat of the resolution, since it would have put the UN Security Council on record backtracking from some previous resolutions regarding Israeli obligations under international law. And hardline elements who oppose Israel's very right to exist are celebrating as well, since the decision by the United States to block the resolution is being interpreted by some as a final nail in the coffin of a two-state solution. By contrast, moderate and centrist pro-Israel groups like Jay Street, called on President Obama not to veto such a resolution. Crazy world, huh? As a result, the Obama administration's decision to block this resolution is not just a defeat for Palestine, it is a defeat for Israel as well. Depends on who you listen to. And again, foreign policy and focus columnist Stephen Zunes is a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. I've met him a number of times and I've heard him speak at the podium. Now, let's get some readers' comments here. Let me grab some cool beverage. It is, it's 4:01 in the afternoon now, this Monday, January 19, on the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, the Monday edition. I'll remind you again, the lovely music you're listening to is from the album The Musicians of the Nile, Luxor to Izna, 1989, Real World and Virgin Records Limited. This is actually the opening number on the album, Al-Bahr Al-Gharam Wasa, Love is as Vast as a River. And before that, you heard some megaphoned voices. I don't know what the issues were, but says here, gives a name to that track, Al-Aksur Izna, from Luxor to Izna. Probably a tour guide pointing out the fascinating cultural aspects of that stretch from Luxor to Izna. Yeah, we are going to get to those internet article readers' comments here, but let me, with this lovely Egyptian folk music in the background, let me pursue a new course for this Mideast Migraines program here. At least open it up to you. Namely, I want to open this up to you, the dear listener. Even if you are not a regular listener, and quite frankly, it's real hard for me to define what is a regular listener to this program. Whether this is your first time listening, or you've tuned in intermittently, or you listen on a regular basis, I need to hear from you about the direction that you think this program is going in. The nature of pirate radio and this Free Radio Santa Cruz service is indeed a pirate underground community news service. What does pirate or underground mean? In the most blatant definition, it means we are not compliant with the Federal Communications Commission, which in strictly legal terms on a federal level, determines and dictates policies laid out by U.S. law and by the leaders, current leaders of the United States government. What kind of restrictions and what kind of freedoms that regular commercial purveyors of radio signals have for their audiences? Limitations on the number and perhaps the geographic spread of stations in the United States are determined by the FCC, Fed Communications Commission. I think probably the most vivid example of their restrictions include the kind of words that you can say on the air, and whether it's so-called safe harbor hours or no. Seven words you cannot say on the radio or on TV, that kind of thing, a la George Carlin. No really bad expletives. And people who've listened to this program will know that those expletives are often expressed on this service. Fuck, shit, motherfucker, that kind of thing. Those kind of expletives that I'm getting at. And whereas the FCC generally puts restrictions on the use of those, even I have occasionally resorted to their use. And I'm probably not the most perfect example of the mindset or the spirit of a free radio host, but I generally like to keep it clean, as you know, regular listeners out there, you lovely people. I'm talking about how the Free Radio Santa Cruz is indeed a pirate radio service, straining to hold on to its assets, its location, its facilities, and transmitter. And we've been successful at doing that almost without interruption, pretty much straight through for the past 20 years. In fact, in March, 2 months from now, will be our 20th anniversary, and you'll hear more soon about the big celebration of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Upcoming in March. As far as I know, the production of a free radio album to be sold in that spirit and in the spirit of donating money to us, still in production as far as I know, and other things like that. But the point is, 20 years of free radio, how do you measure success? Well, to begin with, the fact that it's been 20 years with only one, that I'm aware of, one violent FCC intrusion in the form of a raid on our studios. This was before I knew anything about free radio, when I was still living in Minnesota, in fact. With the exception of that one raid, which, if anything, our both present and past programmers wear as a badge of honor, I certainly would. I do, as a member of the operation now, which is still ongoing. Except for that one raid, it's been pretty much a consistent 20 years of operation. And we are, at the moment, we are streaming live online 24/7, and we are broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial. Now, how is it that I got to talking about the FCC? Being such, in that sense, a low-grade operation and not having all kinds of commercial supporters or corporate sponsors to keep us going, everything and every aspect of this operation is on a constant shoestring. It's on a monetary shoestring. It's on a lot of borrowed money, borrowed time, in some cases maybe even borrowed equipment. And we just make do. The people who have been associated with this operation for the greatest amount of time are well aware of the kind and amount of energy that goes into keeping us up and going. Now, I'm not headed here exclusively to begging a donation from people. This is trying to make sure that my listeners right now understand the nature of free radio and the very limited means we have to research our audience, to know what kind of person is listening, who is listening, who really gets anything useful out of this service. It's hard to imagine. I mean, there are so many different programs, both talk and music, that come across on free radio. It's hard to believe that we're not really making a difference in the lives of anyone out there. But I need to know, what difference, if any, is this program making in your life? Is Mideast Migraines a program of true importance to you? And I'm putting this question out to anyone who happens to be listening to a recording of it, a refeed, rerun, something taken from the archives of Mideast Migraines. Even if it's several months from now, from January 19, 2015, even if someone digs this up 10,000 years from now and listens to it, I need to know from you, yes, you, the unborn, so far, what this program is doing for you. And in order to help accomplish that, I would like to know right now, starting right now, what do you want from me? What do you want from Mideast Migraines? I can take whatever you have to dish out to me, but I really need people to call in. You can hear how blatantly desperate I am for people to call into the program because of the fact that it virtually never happens that I get someone to call in during my program other than wrong numbers and someone having something to say about free radio that has nothing to do with what is on the air right now. If I'm not getting calls on the subject matter, no matter what my indicators tell me about the number of people who were listening online. If I'm not getting callers, then I don't know if I'm helping you. I do not know if I am providing you with information that you need, or if what I have to say is even beginning or has any hope to make any difference out there in terms of a free Palestine, a free and secure Palestine, a free and secure and thriving two states, whichever one you're talking about, or if it goes in the direction of a single binational state, or if it goes in the direction of one single, truly democratic, secular state, which happens to be my personal preference. Is the content of this program contributing towards that, and is the content of this program contributing to your education and your edification of what's going on out there? So I'm going to give you the phone number again, and I want you all to take to heart what I'm saying now, remember it, and talk to your friends about the little debacle that I'm having now about talking about the debacle in the Middle East. Is this program making a difference or not? I want you to call me, area code 831-427-3772. Area code 831-427-3772. And for the first time in a very long time, I'm going to give out the second studio number, as I have been avoiding giving out two numbers just to not have to burden people with remembering too many digits and numbers and just getting them to try to call on line one. Geez, for all this time, I might have been screwing myself because for some technical reason, maybe line two works even better. Line two, same area code, 831. Line two telephone number is 469-3119. That's 469-3119. Now the ringers are on. I usually do not glance over to the blinking red lights on the panel to remind me that there's a call coming in. And so if someone has been trying to call in, I've been missing those lights, and for whatever possible reason the ringers are not working, I apologize. I'm not trying to play a funny on you. I can't always tell visibly if a call is coming on, but I should be able to hear it. Let me give the numbers one more time. These are the phone numbers direct to this live studio. It's 4:22 in the afternoon. We'll be going for about another 38 minutes of programming here. 27 minutes, technically. Area code for both phone lines is 831, Santa Cruz County in Central California on the coast. Area code 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. That's 427-3772. That's line 1. Line 2 is 469-3119. 469-3119. 469-3119. Now, there is, for that matter, there are two alternative ways to contact me with your ideas and comments about the direction of this program. Whether you want to see it continue, whether you want Free Radio to remove it, assuming they can. This program, Mideast Migraines, has its own email address. And in all honesty, quite sadly, the email address has not been ignored completely. I have had people comment on me and on my program and trying to arrange interviews and things, but I have had not much more success with that email address. But here it is, MideastMadness@gmx.com. The email address for this Mideast Migraines radio program, the address is MideastMadness, M-I-D-E-A-S-T, M-A-D-N-E-S-S, all lowercase, all one word run together, MideastMadness@, G as in George, M as in magician, X as in xylophone, but it's an X, not a Z. .com, MideastMadness at gmx.com. MideastMadness at gmx.com. Provide your feedback through that channel. And if you go to our website at freakradio.org, click on the word contact, and you will see a snail mail postal address for free radio as well. You may also want to send your donations to keeping this service going. Just because you're hearing from me during the Mideast Migraine Show does not automatically designate your monies to go to support this show in particular. Even if you were to write on a note in that envelope that you want your money to support Mideast Migraines or any other particular show in particular, frankly, it won't work because we're going to put the monies where we know the monies need to go. So I'm just being open and honest with all of you. Here is that address for you to write on paper with pen or pencil and send through snail mail your comments. It is the same address that you may send a donation to. Right on the envelope, FRSC. You can spell it out, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And here is a phone call coming in. Let me see if I can make this work. You're on free radio. Can you hear me? Hang on. I got to get the right slider up here.
This is Katie, and I'm calling from State Farm. How are you today?
I'm sorry. What's your name? Hello?
My name's Katie. Oh, I was saying that I'm calling on behalf of State Farm. How are you today?
As you can hear, if you're listening to the radio show, I'm doing really well. You're on the air, by the
way. Okay.
You're
Thank
on the
you.
Air. Yeah.
Okay.
What's
Thank
up?
You for your time. Bye-bye.
Now, that I personally don't believe, I do not believe that that's a coincidence. I do not believe that that's a coincidence. That's either someone's idea of a sense of humor. Because I... And that was online, too, by the way, which I've... up until today, not for a long, long time, have I given that number out. But I scared him away, apparently, when I said that you're on the air. And what you just heard is another example of the shoestring quality of the way we do programming on free radio. This is essentially a single room divided, more or less, by two studios. Anyone who has any on-air business does this through Studio A, one of the two studios here. And I'm by myself, so there's no secretary, there's no phone caller or screener or anyone to accept these calls. They come in totally cold, and in my case, they end up coming in on the air. I could isolate the call for a moment, so that the listener, radio listener, is not listening. And, but I just don't bother to do that. I took it for granted that someone was reacting directly to my speech over the last 15-odd minutes. That's the kind of thing that happens on free radio. Okay, let's get back to what I was talking about, whatever the heck that was. I was giving out the address, in the middle of giving out the postal address, so that you can send me your comments and send free radio the money that we ask of you so that we can continue and hopefully improve this service. Here's the address again. Just write FRSC on the envelope. FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, that's two words, S-A-N-T-A, Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z, Santa Cruz, California. The optical character reader symbol for California, of course, is simply C-A. Zip code 95061. I'll give it to you again. And A reminder, if you go to our website at freakradio.org, click on the contact link and you will see the address. Lo and behold, in front of you, in blazing black and red on your computer screen. But I'll just give it to you again. Write, send your donation or requests, comments, etc. to FRSC. Stands for Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can spell it out or you can simply write FRSC 7811. The post office box 7811. Santa Cruz, California 95061. PayPal donations are also taken at www.freakradio.org. Use your PayPal account. So those are the three ways that I would prefer to get your comments. Either call me directly, area code 831-427-3772, or 469-3119, or contact this program. Contact me through the program's email address at MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Or go through our website and send us something in the old-fashioned post office. At the pace of a snail, as it were. Okay. It's 4:31 p.m. This is the Mideast Migraine Show. I am your host, Ren Tawil. Comments directed to Professor Stephen Zunes, UCSF. Article here. The latest blow to Israeli-Palestinian peace. Sam Bryan writes, a U.S. spokesman has said that the Palestinians going to court is an impediment to peace. How can that be said, especially when their own attempts to end an illegal, unjust occupation have been thwarted by an administration in Israel that values appropriation of land more than peace, and by administrations in the U.S. that are in lockstep with Israel. Seeking justice an impediment to peace, in this case, is what one says when they had rather be on the good side of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rather than on the right side of history. Sadly, they are trying to rob the Palestinians of what little hope they have left, and at the same time tragically failing to act in the best interests of the United States. Well, that certainly sounds well said. Sam Bryan there, responding to Stephen Zunes' article. Regardless of what one thinks about the truthfulness of his comments, I'm not saying one way or the other whether it's true or not. Here, Pan Skeptic makes another comment. The Obama administration is deeply tired of the stale, intransigent, unreliable Netanyahu government in Israel and hope for a regime change, as do I. The U.S. rightly saw a passage of this resolution as bolstering Netanyahu's re-election chances and fought it for that reason. Interesting take. Sometimes this publication is so eager to blame Israel first that it comes off as naive. You guys need to refocus. Well, Pan Skeptic appears to be someone who reads Zunes' column here, Foreign Policy in Focus, constantly. I do not. Okay, Chris Burrell says, I see no statement in the resolution allowing Israel to annex occupied territory in East Jerusalem and parts of the West Bank near the original border where the majority of Israeli settlers live. I do not see where Israel, quote, transferred any civilian populations onto territory seized by military force. The movement of Israelis settling into unused and unowned portions of what are the disputed Palestinian territories is quite legal, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. Okay, this Chris Burrell is someone who is clearly parroting a lot of very pro-Israel, very pro-settler language and positions. He says, I do not see where Israel, quote, transferred any civilian populations onto territory seized by military force. Maybe he doesn't see it in the resolution, but that is clearly the history since 1948 and 1967. That is not disputed, except perhaps by some Israelis. As far as Israelis settling into unused and unowned portions of Palestinian territories, they're having a remarkable effect on the property of many Palestinian Arabs through this whole Zionist settler project. They're slicing and dicing up the land and villages and the access between those lands and villages of Arabs through their Zionist enterprise. They're doing it quite deliberately and at great dedicated cost. And of course, this Chris Burrell person uses the phrase disputed Palestinian territories. This is a very weak phraseology that's come into play in just the last few years, trying to substitute for illegally occupied territories, or simply saying disputed Palestinian territories. And on what they say, on what basis they say it is disputed, they never seem to elaborate or spell out. Finally, Barney says, the United States says the resolution is, quote, deeply unbalanced, question mark. I had no idea the U.S. favored balance in this conflict. Presumably, unless it sees some requirements made of Israel, the U.S. will veto the quartet principles, referring to the Peace Party quartet that was put together a decade or so ago. These require, as a precondition for statehood, that a Palestinian state must recognize the state of Israel without prejudging what various grievances or claims are appropriate, abide by previous diplomatic agreements, and renounce violence as a means of achieving goals. Perhaps for balance, the quartet can demand Israel recognize Palestine as a state and its occupations, end its occupations, and renounce violence before we recognize Israel as a state. I'm guessing the U.S. has suddenly gone off the idea of balance. As an aside, I thought Gandhi was the only person to have ever renounced violence from obtaining goals. Are American leaders all pacifists all of a sudden, or hypocrites? All food for thought, folks. Okay, let's move on to something else here. Now, I'm going to keep saying this till the end of the show, and I'm going to repeat the essential message on every subsequent show for a long, long time now until we get some movement. Rather than me giving the whole 15, 20-minute spiel that you just heard me give, I'm going to ask people to refer to the program of January 19, 2015. That's this program. This program will be archived, God willing, because we do have prohibitive technical problems that somehow prevent that from happening. But this program is being recorded, and I'm going to have it archived at the two alternative websites where the archives for Mideast Migraines programs lie. RadioForAll.net, that's RADIO, the number 4, ALL.NET, RadioForAll.net, RadioForAll.net is where you'll find the archives of all of my past recorded programs. Just keep in mind, the program for this day, January 19, 2015, contains a beseechment, a request, a dire request for people to contribute to the future of this program. I'm not talking about money here. I'm talking about your ideas for the direction that this program should go, and I want to hear back from you. The January 19 program of Mideast Migraines. Look for it in the archives so you can hear again the details of what I want from you, the listener, whether you're listening live or listening to a refeed or an archived episode. The other alternative website where my shows are filed away is Santa Cruz Media Center Indie Bay. Just Santa Cruz Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Indie Bay. Santa Cruz Indie Bay is pretty much all you have to remember. Google that, go to that website. Click on Palestine or look at recent feeds in the right-hand green box on the right-hand edge, long linear edge of the screen for my programs. So we have archives at Indie Bay, archives at radioforall.net. If you missed my spiel, write down the date, January 19. Look that up so you can hear from me the long explanation of what I ask for and require of you, the listener, for the sake of the future of this program. If I hear nothing from anyone, I'm just going to go on basically the way that I'm going. And if this show falls short of its potential, is not changing anyone else's lives, is not edifying or educating anyone else, and if it is not having the slightest difference in the future of peace in Israel and Palestine, then so be it. I'm just going to keep on doing it like I've been doing it. So I need to hear from you, the listener, about whether or not what I'm doing is making a difference. I know you're out there. I'm not getting any phone calls. What's the matter, folks? Don't you believe in your own ability to evaluate and judge the efficacy of a radio program? You can hear now that I'm getting mean. Mean. Hungry for some responses. All right. Let's move on to something else. Mean but frustrated, folks. I can come up with all kinds of materials and just sit here and play them for you, play Arabic music or Greek music that pretends to be Arabic or something like that. And I got to find that album again, by the way. I can talk your ears off and talk my mouth off and my tongue right out of my mouth. But if I don't get an indication that this is making a difference in anyone's life, then nothing will change, including the fact that I'll continue going on doing whatever program I see fit. Personally, my best moments are interviews, either interviews that I am having with individuals, like the one that I had 2 days ago with Greta Berlin, one of the two co-writers of the Freedom Sailors book that I'm over halfway through with now in the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, which comes to you every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Pacific time. Or the interview that John Malkin graciously invited me to, and I spoke for some 45 or 50 minutes. And I'm trying to make sure that that interview gets replayed and replayed, at least for a while here. Again, that's to me, those are the high points. Those are the exciting points. Those are instances when I'm actually talking to a real live person, whether in the studio here or remotely by phone. I expect to have more interviews with real, living, breathing people as we continue with the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's 4:44 p.m. The Lab. L-A-B, as in laboratory. What is The Lab? The Lab, quote unquote, The Lab is a movie which is available, although of the many Palestine-oriented and Israel-oriented films that have come out in recent years, particularly over the past decade or so, The Lab, I suspect that people are having difficulty getting a hold of this one, and for good reason. I'm going to play you the track of an Israeli soldier. I think he's retired. If it weren't so short, only a few minutes long, I wouldn't bother, because he's speaking in Hebrew the entire time. I'm going to play it just so you can hear his Hebrew in the background, and I'll read you the English translation. So here we go with that. Planted by the Israelis, was found in the office of the U.S. ambassador in 19... 19- attaché. Retired diplomat Don Burgess recalls the episode. Our ambassador, Ed Lawson, reported the bug in a telegram to Washington. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, and you're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show. My deepest apologies. My God, this potentially throws a huge monkey wrench into the whole operation here. I just discovered that while I am producing what is supposed to be a purely live program, has been interrupted or cross-fed by an earlier recorded program on Free Radio. I do not know how that happened. Then again, oh, okay, I'm sorry, I'm obviously a little confused here. Oh, that's a relief. I think we're in the clear now. Let me just explain what happened. I realized that while I've been talking, apparently for most or all of this program, the queue, you know, the lineup of recorded programs that we have to play when no one is here in the studio, that had been going on. I'm sorry again. I just panicked a little. I'm looking at the waveform, which is an indicator of whether or not my voice is coming across over the airwaves or streaming, and it looked as though that it was fine. So, okay, no, it's all right. I think we're good. I just kind of flipped out there, so just erase the last couple of minutes. Our queue was going, for people who know what Winamp is and what that kind of thing is all about. But that's... Okay, we're good. That's out of the way now. So let me get back to... okay, now I'm going to try this again. We're talking about The Lab, which is a film... because we're getting so close to the end of the program, let's not do the translation of the video. Let's just get right into reading this thing here, okay? From Dissident Voice, a radical newsletter in the struggle for peace and social justice. Broadly speaking, not just in Palestine and Israel, but from Dissident Voice, the Israeli lab is in laboratory, L-A-B, the Israeli lab and the Palestinian guinea pigs, by Gilad Atzmon. June 15, 2013. The Lab is a new, groundbreaking Israeli documentary film as of June 15, 2013, that redefines our entire understanding of the Jewish state, its aims, its identity, and its global destructive role. I honestly believe that this film is the deepest and most important commentary on Israel. In The Lab, director Yotam Feldman exposes the Israeli military industry and its operation. He interviews some major protagonists within Israel's, quote, security trade. He elaborates on the role of the industry within the Israeli society and economy. In the last few years, Israeli security exports reached an unprecedented level of $7 billion a year. That's Israeli security exports reached an unprecedented level of $7 billion a year. A full 20% of Israeli exports are military or military-related. Approximately 150,000 families in Israel are dependent on that industry. Israel is now the fourth biggest military exporter, and again, that is as of a year and a half ago, anyway. In the last decade, every Israeli military operation led to an immediate sharp increase in sales of Israeli military export around the world. Weaponry, systems, intelligence, strategies, doctrines, knowledge, and experience. Feldman, director Yotam, the lab director Yotam Feldman, provides us with a glimpse into a very organized universe. We visit Israeli weapon fairs around the world, but we also see arenas filled to capacity with foreign generals, public officials, and diplomats. They are all shopping for Israeli military products. The message is clear, and $7 billion is just part of the story. Israeli military elite is now deeply interwoven with the political and military elite of every country around the globe. This emerging Israeli business buys the Jewish state influence and support. The Lab makes it evidently clear that the Palestinian civilian population in the West Bank and Gaza have become test subjects for Israeli tactics, weaponry, and fighting philosophy. Quote, fighting Torah, or Torat Lechima, as the Israelis call it. They're fighting philosophy. Fighting Torah. The destruction of the Palestinians has now been transformed into a very profitable industry. We're dealing here with nothing short of highly calculated murder. Through a set of fascinating interviews, Feldman conveys a very genuine picture of the Israeli death merchants. Feldman lets them talk. He hardly interferes. They are sharp. They are genuine. They are even funny at times. Occasionally witty. And a few of them might even be charming if you did not know who they are. But make no mistake, they are sinister. Some of them are clearly psychotic. They are mass murderers and they are free. They sell destruction and havoc and do it very successfully. Being myself an Israeli-born and raised successful musician and writer, and again, the author of this article in Dissident Voice is Gilad Atzmon. Being myself an Israeli born and raised successful musician and writer, I think I can recognize Israeli dedication, perseverance, and creativity when I see it, no matter into what service it is pressed. And then he says parenthetically here, perhaps I was lucky to be rescued by bebop. Those Israeli death angels' talents is driven into the amplification of human misery. The consequences are tragic. Game changer. New subheading here. It is far from being a secret that a century of Palestinian struggle led to practically nothing. The state of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement is even more embarrassing. The lab is a game changer, for it can explain decades of impotence. We are immersed in flawed terminology. Colonialism, apartheid, conflict, solution, Zionism are just a few examples. Gaza is now a vast laboratory. The Israelis are the, quote, scientists and the, quote, technicians. The Palestinians are the guinea pigs. Watching the lab must lead all of us to fundamentally question our notions. We're dealing with a premeditated war crime. The notion of resolution, as in two-state solution, for instance, is not applicable. It is clear beyond doubt that in the real world, the, quote, scientist does not negotiate with the, quote, guinea pig. The scientist also doesn't consider sharing reality with his guinea pig in a one democratic state. The lab is a glimpse into the Israeli mind. You clearly do not find much compassion there. And this, remember, this is an Israeli who's writing this. For decades, we were foolish to examine the success and failure of Israeli military operations in reference to Israeli military and political, quote, objectives, as we surmise them. We were clearly wrong. As we learn from Feldman's film, the real objective of Israeli operations may as well be examining new doctrines and operational systems in order to distribute them around the world soon after. Ehud Barak, for instance, wasn't exactly the most sophisticated Israeli minister of defense. He clearly failed to defend his people or even make them feel secure. However, he was very successful in selling Israeli weapons and doctrines. Tel Aviv being subject to a barrage of Qassam rockets may be seen by Israelis as devastating news, but from a military-industrial point of view, it was a golden opportunity to examine and promote the Israeli anti-missile system Iron Dome. If I'm correct here, it becomes clear that, like the Palestinians, more and more Israelis are also becoming guinea pigs in this ever-growing military laboratory. One may wonder how and when the Zionist dream transformed itself into a military business. Only a few of us, writers and scholars, have attempted to answer this question. The transformation of the Jewish state into an oppression factory is apparently a direct outcome of Israel's supremacist ideology. If we want to understand what is happening in the Jewish state, we must first grasp the notions of Jewishness, Jewishness, and Jewish identity politics. I guess that enough Palestinians in Gaza do realize by now that they have been part of an Israeli experiment. Every so often we learn from Palestinian doctors that while treating casualties of Israeli aggression, they encounter new types of wounds. The lab explains it, but it isn't Palestine alone. We also witness a growing similarity between the operational mode of police forces around the world, folks, and the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, treatment of the Palestinians. Watching Otam Feldman's The Lab explains it all. We are the Palestinians. We are either occupied by Israel or by its proxy forces around the world. Those who are trained in Israel and implement Israeli weaponry and tactics. And then there are a couple of links in this Dissident Voice article. Watch foreign generals shopping around. Remember that phrase and Google that. Foreign general shopping around. Or watch IDF Yoav Gallant, YoavGallant, the planner and executioner of Operation Cast Lead, discussing proportions, quote-unquote, proportions. Incidentally, about the author, Gilad Atzmon, now living in London, England, was born in Israel and served in the Israeli military. He is the author of The Wandering Who, and one of the most accomplished jazz saxophonists in Europe. And he can be reached at such and such an address. Read other articles by Gilad or visit Gilad's website. Gilad Atzmon, last name Atzmon. Gilad is spelled G-I-L-A-D. All right, folks, it's just about 5 o'clock. Time to move along here. I thank you ever so much for listening in your stately quietness, as it were. I'm not trying to be mean. I just, you know, trying to, let's see. Impress upon people that I'd still like to hear from you. One way or another. Now that I'm leaving the studio, you can still call me. I'll be here for a while. Or you can send your message to MidEastToMadness@gmx.com. I'm killing time as I need to pull up the audio for today's program. And here is Palestine Today.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center.